Greetings, greetings, and welcome to the show. This is Wrong Place, Right Crime. I am your host, Frank Zaffiro, and we are in the middle. In fact, we are deep, deep into a 12-episode series retrospective for A Grifter Song. Actually, more of a celebration, I would call it. What is A Grifter Song? Well, if this is your first episode, let me tell you, it is a novella anthology series published by Down and Out Books that I created and edit that features two grifters, Rachel and Sam, who are devoted to each other and to the con and not much else in this world. Every episode features them in a new location, attempting a new con of some sort. These outings are all written by different authors, so the voices are different. The points of view are different. The writing style is different. And this is really proved over 35 episodes, 35 small books, to keep the series very fresh. And yet, because it's Rachel and Sam together, the same characters again and again, there is a level of familiarity and comfort for you, the reader. So it's a nice combination. But like all good things, it must come to an end. And on October 1st, 2023, the 35th and final episode, the series finale, Into the Dying Sun, will drop to celebrate the wonderful authors that took part in this series and wrote some outstanding episodes. We are walking through each of these books one at a time, talking to the authors about their experience and their thoughts on the story that they wrote. And as the series creator and editor, I've been dropping a few tidbits here and there, a little behind the scenes stuff where appropriate, to give you, the listener, a picture of what you can expect if you pick up this series. Now, this time out, we are going to talk about episodes 27, 28, and 29. That's The Low White Plain by Paul J. Garth, Dangerous to Know by Hilary Davidson, and Madame Tomahawk by Nick Kolakowski. All of these books, and indeed the entire series, is published by Down and Out Books. They are also sponsoring this retrospective, so you can find out more about them at downandoutbooks.com. That's Down and Out Books, all spelled out, .com. So let us dive straight into The Low White Plain by Paul J. Garth. To give you the background a little bit of how Paul came to be involved in this project, he and I were both in an anthology called The Eviction of Hope that was published by Original Ink Press, edited by Colin Conway. And Paul had a story in there called The Hope of Lost Mares. And, you know, I might be a sucker for horses. There's no question there. But the story was just incredibly well written and with such a unique voice. And it just really bowled me over. It might have been my favorite in the entire anthology. That's hard to say because there were like half a dozen other ones that bowled me over too. It was an incredible lineup, The Eviction of Hope. You should check it out. But the thing I liked about Paul's work was that it was beautifully written. It was very evocative, and the language was fun to read and luxuriate in. But it didn't happen at the expense of story or character. And sometimes you get one or the other. Like sometimes you get a really, you know, well-written story that cranks along and you're just totally into the story and into the character and it's great. Other times you might get something that's just beautifully written and you kind of have to sacrifice the fact that, you know, we're not going to go Mach 3 in this story here. Let's bask in the way the story is being told a little bit. And you know, both methods are good, and you might, you know, be in the mood for one or the other at any given time, or you might prefer one over the other. But here with Paul Garth, I think you get both. And it reminded me a little bit of Dennis Lehane. Now, of course, that's lofty praise. I mean, earlier in this series, I compared Matt Phillips to Elmore Leonard. I think that's a fair comparison. It's not a one for one. They both have their own styles. And certainly Dutch has a considerably higher profile than anybody I know. But the comparison is apt. And it is here as well. Because Paul does the same thing that I see in Dennis Lehane's work. And that is, he writes in a way that is just gorgeous, but it doesn't come at the expense of telling a great story. Now, in Lehane's case, I'm referring a lot to his Kinsey and Gennaro series, which is actually my favorite series of his. But he does it in Any Given Day, and he does it obviously in Mystic River. But you know, you don't forget you're reading a mystery, you're reading a detective story, and it's still gritty and it's still got that dark feeling to it. But then it's also beautiful prose, but not in a way that's obtrusive. And so that's what I mean when I compare Paul to Dennis Lehane's work. Their style is different. Their voice is different. He's not a carbon copy or anything. It's a similar talent is really what I'm saying. I don't think I'm alone in appreciating Paul's style of writing. I've had several conversations with other authors who admire it. In fact, I think some of them mention it during this podcast retrospective. Paul is like one of those guys who he's like the musician that other musicians like and admire. And it's not always the most popular musician that other musicians like and admire. It's the one who's doing something different or doing something hard extraordinarily well, or just has a very unique voice or style. And you know, other musicians take note and admire it because of the craft involved. And writers are that way too. Now, I hope Paul becomes a very well-known author. I hope that for all of the Grifter Song authors. They all deserve it. But it is interesting to me that a lot of other authors cite Paul's work as one of their favorites in the series. And I think it has to do with that. When you see other writers admiring a writer's work, you know, take note because there's something special going on there. Anyway, enough gushing. Let's talk about the story itself. I've mentioned before, one of the great things about this series is the sense of location that the authors give to their particular outing. And in this episode, Sam and Rachel are in Nebraska, and it is a very bleak version of Nebraska. It's the Charles Starkweather, Nebraska. It is even the weather is against them, and they are down. They are at a low ebb. And this has happened in a few other episodes where they're kind of, you know, there are peaks and valleys when you're living as a grifter, and they are in a very deep valley at this point. And it only gets deeper. They get tied into a kidnapping scheme, and then they realize that this actually involves some powerful men, and then some crazy cult stuff comes up. And I don't really want to say anymore because I don't want to ruin it. It's a great read. I will tell you that it is the longest episode. Paul exceeded the 30,000 word count limit by a healthy margin, a few thousand words. And he's the only one that did, and it was worth it. The story needed it, and he delivered. And it's a read that is not going to feel like it's the longest one, I don't think. Interestingly enough, that's not the only rule he broke. He also is the first episode not to feature some kind of an object in the foreground. As you may recall, the layout of the different covers has Sam and Rachel's faces on the sides, and then in the background, some kind of a landscape that evokes the place where the episode occurs, and then an item in the foreground that kind of stands for you know, something in the plot. For instance, in Ghost Image, Kat Richardson's outing, Sam was Rachel's assistant, and he pretended to have a whole bunch of devices that could detect ghosts and other things. And so there's a goofy looking a little scanner gun with a dish detector on the end of it. There's a scene placard for Concrete and Cocaine, Vincent Zandri's, a bottle of wine for Dracula wine. You know, there's all of these different items that are there. There's a script for the Down and Out, Lawrence Bannock's outing, a camera for The Rule of Thirds, and it goes on and on. So for the low white plane, there is no item in the foreground. And that's entirely fitting. And it was a great choice. And I'm glad that Paul lobbied for it. But dude is a total rule breaker, man. In a good way. All right. So I have said more than enough about this. Let's hear what Paul's thoughts are on the low white plane. Well, hey, Paul, welcome back to the show. Why don't I ask you the first question straight away? When you were asked to join the series and pen an episode, what made you say yes?
It's funny. I almost said no, actually. And I'm so thankful that I didn't. But a couple of weeks before, some friends and I were having a conversation, like Curtis Polito and James D. F. Hanna. And we were talking about Grifter's Song, and there was another kind of invite series for a little bit. We were talking about, like, well, how do you get into that? And then you sent me an email inviting me. And I remember, you know, it was 2021, so I had like a 2-year-old at home. I was working with Rock in a Hard Place, editing Shotgun Honey. I was working on a novel with Dennis Tafoya, working on my own short stories. I was almost like, man, this is cool, but I don't have the bandwidth to do it. I remember I was talking to my wife about it one day. You know, she was like, you know, you should give it a go. Like, why not? We can find something else to take off your plate. You should. It sounds cool. You got invited. So that was pretty much the decision for me. Like, this was always something I really wanted to do. This was something I really wanted to do, and it seemed challenging and interesting. But it also seemed really, it seemed like too good of an opportunity to pass up, to like go into this world that has its own rules and has been touched by so many people, and then make a conscious effort of being like, okay, well, this is how I do things, and I'm going to see if the two can coexist together. And then thankfully they did. It worked out better than I imagined in a lot of ways.
And your story was a story that you came up with for this series, or was this something that was bouncing around in your head and this just turned out to be a great vehicle for it?
Yeah, no, this was a story that I came up with for a Grifter Song. A lot of my characters are, well, they're not con men, right? I generally don't write about people who are like two steps ahead of everyone else in the room, just because I was honestly worried that like that would rob dramatic tension from stories. So it was something I'd never tried before. So I sat down and I was like, okay, what kind of con could I do that is gritty and tough and introduces elements of danger to it, but that still counts as a con? And I got the fake kidnapping from there. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you did an interesting thing in your episode in that you worked in this fake kidnapping, but you also worked in essentially, you could call it political extremism or religious extremism or a combination of both. But that wasn't immediately apparent in the setup, in the premise, but you worked it in.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think of the Low White Plain, you know, is it the longest Grifter Song? It ended up being like 36,000 words, right? That's really up there.
Yeah, you were a rule violator in a couple of ways, but I enjoyed your other story that in a book that we both had stories in so much that I definitely wanted you to be part of this. And the story was so good that, you know, sometimes rules just have to be violated. And luckily enough, you were close enough to the end that I didn't have a lot of people pointing to your exception to get their own authorized.
Yeah. I took a big swing with it when I realized kind of the secret motivations behind this fake kidnapping. And then a couple other things I put into play a little earlier, because I really wanted to do an entry where Sam and Rachel were like on their back feet the whole time. So when I had that together, I was like, oh, this might be a little bit more than Frank was asking for. So in a lot of ways, I think of The Low White Plain as my first book. Like, you know, technically I know it's a novella, but it's close enough to that kind of that line where things start to blur that I'm like, okay, yeah, I feel comfortable calling it that. And also I feel comfortable calling it that because I don't think it hit everything I wanted to do, but it hit a lot. I feel like it's a pretty decent calling card for my interests and my abilities and to do that in the middle of this series that I did not create and was just asked to come aboard on. I'm really, really proud of that.
Was that tough for you, playing within an existing rule set?
I thought it was going to be really hard when I started. I really thought it was going to be really, really difficult. But thankfully, once I kind of got in there, once I understood the dynamic between Sam and Rachel, it became much easier, especially knowing that I have a story Bible to flesh them out and to kind of make their experiences whole. I can reference things that I know that have happened in the past, but that aren't like explicitly spelled out. So I can build, I thought of them as shards, like little shards of character that as long as they don't conflict with this and they don't conflict emotionally, it'll still work. And then I was able to kind of build my version of character off of those shards.
You know, every one of these episodes takes place in a different location. I thought yours was an episode that really focused on the nature of Nebraska. And of course, a very dark version of it. I'm sure that it's a beautiful place with wonderful people. But you chose to highlight a very bleak view of it and make the place almost a character unto itself.
Yeah, so that's something I try to do in a lot of stuff. And I think it reflects my kind of literary upbringing. I'm not from Nebraska. I've lived here for a long time now, but I'm not from here. I grew up in South Carolina. So, you know, I'd walk outside and there'd be these trees and you'd walk into the trees and oh my, you know, there's a mansion here 100 years ago that burned down and here's the foundation. And you'd walk a little bit more through the woods and there'd be a, piece of wood nailed to a tree that says like Jesus Christ is risen. It was, you know, I just inhaled that Southern Gothic atmosphere. And so when I started writing about Nebraska, I was like, here's the truth. Most people here are really nice. And we have a lot of beautiful days, including today. Like I'm in the middle of one right now, but that's not like, that doesn't give me the mood that I'm really like digging for, the mood that calls to me both artistically, or, you know, in terms of enjoying things. So I made a conscious decision, when I first started writing, like I'm going to present Nebraska as this, like, I'm going to bring Southern Gothic techniques and moods and place it here, create like my own version of the bleak Midwest. And so to put Sam and Rachel in that, especially because they don't have like a ton of rural adventures, right?
No.
So to put them here in a place where they're already feeling, you know, things with teeth are closer to them than they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And to put them here and trap them here and then give them a con that, of course, goes sideways. It was just like really a culminating stack of things.
Yeah, it really comes through. They have been in situations where they're in smaller towns. I think of Eric Pruitt's episode, for example, or you mentioned James D.F. Hanna.
James, this is so good.
Yeah, his episode. So, and that leads well to my next question, and that is, have you read some of the other episodes?
Yeah, yeah. I love Holly West's. Holly's is so good. I love James's version. Curtis's, Nick Kolowski's. I've read pretty much everything that has come after mine. Several that have come before, but pretty much everything that has come after mine has been something that I've really, really wanted to check out, because in the course of, you know, writing this, in the course of spending so much time with Sam and Rachel, like I became even more invested in them than I was previously. I went from a reader and appreciator of them to someone who's like, they have a little bit of me in them as things have gone forward, and I have a little bit of them in me, and I want to see them through.
That's a real good way to put, I think, a little bit of the magic that has come out of this series from my perspective. So I appreciate you saying that. we're at the end, you know, Into the Dying Sun is the final episode dropping on October 1st. If it was your series to write the ending to, how would you end it for Sam and Rachel?
I have two thoughts on this. And they both kind of tie together. I think they have to go back to Philadelphia. I think they have to confront what waits them so that they can go back out into the world and do what they do with just a little bit less tension on them so that they can really enjoy themselves. I know that one of my first thoughts would be, well, let's get them like a giant score. Let's get them a score they can retire off of and just buy a boat and like sail around the Mediterranean. But I also think that, you know, if they did that, they would have probably about 3 days before they're bored as hell with that. And they'd be off stealing something else.
They'd become pirates or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Into the Dying Sun, the sunset, like I want to see him ride off into the sunset. I want to see him resolve, you know, really the big threat that has been hanging over them for so long. And I want to see him keep on doing what they do best.
Well, that's fantastic. I guess it won't be long now before you'll be able to find out if that's what happens.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
So if people read The Low White Plain, they want to read more of your work. You know, what's your most recent release or what do you have coming out and where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter or Blue Sky, just Paul J. Garth at both places. On Twitter, I have a thread with pinned to the top where people can see all my short stories. A lot of them are available to read for free if some of them cost money. But that's where we're at now. As far as longer stuff, I have a novel that is currently being shopped that I co-wrote with the wonderful Dennis Tafoya. That's called The Throwaway, and hopefully we will have news to share about that soon. And in the meantime, I'm currently at work on my next solo big thing, my next big solo project. It is a novel. It is set in Nebraska. It is mean. I'll put it this way. If you like The Low White Plain, I think you will dig the hell out of what I'm working on now.
Does it have a title?
So far, the working title is A Prayer for Violence.
Ooh.
So we'll see if that changes.
All right. Well, thanks for writing a great episode, Paul. And thanks for being part of this retrospective.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Frank. And thank you for inviting me to be a part of this. It has been incredible.
All right. There you go. Paul, another individual who is very articulate when it comes to the craft of writing. All of the writers that I chose for this are talented, and I know they think these things. Some just put it into spoken word when interviewed, and Paul certainly is able to do that. So The Low White Plain, episode 27 of A Grifter Song. Grab it and check out Paul's other work as well. All right, moving on to episode 28, and that is Dangerous to Know by Hillary Davidson. Now, Hillary was a guest on the podcast a while back. A real pleasure to talk to one of the nicest people that I've come across in the crime fiction community. And that's saying a lot because it is chock full of just outstanding folks. And really, you know, I know that sounds like lip service, but I've had this conversation with other writers and it's hard to find somebody who you would say is a jerk or not fun to be around. Anyway, swinging back to where we should be, talking about Hillary Davidson, it was a great interview. Check it out. Virtually all of the authors who have been part of A Grifter Song have appeared on Wrong Place, Right Crime at some point. Just tap their name into the search line there, and you'll get an episode that's chock full of information about them. Sometimes it's about the Grifter Song episode. But it always goes into their other work as well. And Hillary and I spoke at length about her book and her process and just a delightful person to talk to. Now, her story is one of, I think, only two that take place outside of the U.S. Matt Phillips has Tijuana as the setting for The Rule of Thirds. And Hillary chose British Columbia, specifically the Vancouver area. Now, she is Canadian, and so that probably factored into the choice. But she'll talk about it a little bit in the interview, so I won't spoil that. This is another episode that does delve into artwork theft, although this has to do more with the, I would call it archaeological theft. Sure, they're pieces of art, but not in the same way that the paintings in Still Life with Suitcase or Dracula Wine or some of the others were. This is more along the lines of museum pieces. As you'll hear from Hillary, it's a situation where Sam and Rachel come up against some of their own and have to deal with that. And really, if I were to pick something out about this episode that I thought was, you know, what made it different or special. Of course, it's always the voice of the author. That goes without saying. That's true in you know, 30 different instances. But here, once again, we have a real good sense of place. Hillary really captures Vancouver, and having been there and spent some time there, I can attest to the authenticity of her depiction. But I think what I liked the most was what I mentioned earlier, that they run up against their own kind here, and there are some external forces going on as well that they have to deal with. But it seems like sometimes the biggest challenges that they face are other grifters or other criminals anyway. And I like that. I like what that brings out in them. I like the danger it brings to the situation. And well, one other small thing that I did like about this was that she did a call back to the Alpha Whisperer. And so this mark that they found was, you know, based on some information that they obtained in that episode. So a lot of the authors do callbacks to various degrees. And one of the things I did as the editor is try to work those in where I could organically to try to stitch the series together even more than just the existence of Sam and Rachel in each episode. And then some of the authors did it for me, like in this case here. So I appreciated that. All right, you've heard enough of me. Let's hear directly from Hillary Davidson about Dangerous to Know, her episode of A Grifter Song, clocking in at number 28.
I've been asking everybody the first question in this retrospective. When you got the opportunity to decide whether or not to come aboard this project, what was it that convinced you, I'm going to do this?
Okay, don't laugh, but it was your podcast. In all seriousness, I remember you interviewing me several years ago, and the podcast was great, but we had great side conversation. And I think we kept in touch a little bit after that. And so I had, of course, already, you know, been familiar with the series. But when you asked me to work on it, I was like, oh, I'll be working with Frank, and that would be cool. So it was honestly, I felt like we had a really good kind of rapport. And, you know, in honesty, I had asked around about, you know, authors who'd worked with you, what they thought. And it was just universal, like respect, love. So it was kind of a no-brainer to say yes.
I'm flattered. That's really nice. So your story is, I think, I should know, but I haven't read them all recently, but I think yours is the only one that takes place in Canada. And so I'm curious, when you did decide to do this and you decided to set it in British Columbia, which I thought was great, was this story something absolutely 100% fresh for A Grifter Song, or was it were elements of it brewing already and this was a good outlet for them?
Oh, gosh. I think there's always sort of this mental compost heap where I have these ideas that sometimes keep showing up in different work. And I will say that one of those is this sort of trade in illegal antiquities, because it's sort of been known to finance terrorism. We know of these incidents like the Iraqi Archaeological Museum being looted, and we're still now just starting to find out where those pieces went. So that's something that has come up kind of again and again, whether often in peripheral ways in my work. It's often my way of indicating, here's a really bad character. They want things that belong in a museum. That's an issue. So I will say that part of it, was something I got to explore in depth in this story, because I talk about that a lot more. Knowing the series, knowing the grifts, I thought, wow, this is a grift that they've never been part of before. And knowing that some parts of the U.S. have been really well covered and well written about in the series, I wanted to do something fresh. I've had the pleasure of visiting British Columbia numerous times. I have friends there, and I've never set anything there. And so I felt like this would be such a great opportunity for them to sort of take on this new con and go in this direction. So I guess it was really a mix of like a longstanding interest I had and kind of a love of a place that I've never written about. So that all came together.
How was that experience for you, having to adhere to a set of rules as opposed to having free rein like you might in your own books? Was that difficult, or did you embrace it, or how was that for you?
I honestly loved it, which is a very strange thing to admit, because, you know, speaking generally, my books, I write them, it's, you know, came from my crazy brain, and I can go in whatever direction I want. And I would always say I love that freedom, especially with standalones where you're not kind of wedded to a character Bible. You don't have to have this consistent universe. I love that freedom. But the other side of that coin is that I often, because I'm a seat of the pants kind of writer who doesn't chart out my course in advance, I often struggle with that and with plotting, and even with smaller details, sometimes I will change my mind while I'm writing, and that can slow me down. I end up having to go back over chapters I've written already to make them consistent with what comes later. And so I create all of this extra work for myself that I could often kick myself for, because I end up throwing away, for every book I write, I throw away thousands of words, sometimes tens of thousands of words, and it's not the best process. This was very streamlined because you've got the characters, you've got the sort of, there are side characters who could show up in their world. You've got incidents from the past that you don't have to draw on, but you can include it. You can sort of integrate that into the world. And so I loved it because there was a framework that I couldn't deviate from. So all of those little chattering voices saying, what if you did this? And what if you did that? They had to shut up because, you know, the sort of the world that these characters inhabit is the world they inhabit. And so the focus became much more on the grift, the sort of their relationship, which to me is really core to the story, and the relationship of the other characters that they're dealing with. I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, but the other grifters that they meet up with in this episode. So it allowed me really to focus.
You mentioned the relationship between the two. A lot of the writers who have talked about this, that was sort of what they said was what they liked best about these characters. Is that true for you too, or is there another thing about them that really caught your eye or interested you?
No, honestly, I mean, I would say there are many things that interest me, but in terms of what gives the series that's kind of its heart, its core, it is the relationship between Sam and Rachel. It's because you've got them always, you know, they're always playing different roles, always, you know, kind of on the hustle, but their love for each other is real and true, and it's the one touchstone in this world. It's how they survive. I don't think there would be a series. I don't think they, you know, would have survived the first few episodes if they didn't have that. And so to me, there's something beautiful about having that as kind of the cornerstone of it.
I think you're really onto something there. It's in my vision of it was always that their love was the one true thing that they trusted absolutely. And everything else in the world might be in shades of gray, but that was very black and white. Your story can fairly be described as rather twisty. Was there a favorite part for you that you wrote or thought about and just went, wow, this is cool, I'm excited about this?
Oh, maybe the sort of the first twist, because I was thinking about you know, twists in the book. And I always hate to give away, you know, spoilers always drive me crazy, but I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to talk about the first twist in the book, which is you've got the two main characters. They've set up their grift. They've got their identities. They know exactly what they're doing. They're thoroughly in character. And they come up against this crazy wall, this scenario that I don't know. I haven't read every installment of the series, but I don't remember them ever coming up against this in the past, where it's basically like their grifter's on the make and they come up against a bigger grifter who's on the make and who's determined to use them. And it's made very bald very quickly. I mean, obviously they've come up with many people who've been determined to use them too, but it, the way that the role reverses and predator becomes prey, it happens really early in the book and kind of, I think, throws the kind of dynamic, it just twists it completely. And after that, you're like, what do they do now? There is something always delicious in having characters that are very confident about something and pulling the rug out from under them. I mean, this is not the first time I've done that to characters, being honest.
You mentioned that you had read some of the other installments. Were there any that just jumped out at you as being favorites?
Oh gosh. So there are several. I feel terrible that, you know, there are actually so many, and I will probably forget some favorites. But when I think of like what got me into the series, so honestly, the first installment, The Concrete Smile, I loved that. And I still remember how that opened and just the immediate, you know, in the first paragraph, you get a strong sense of who Sam is. And I just love that it just dragged me into the story so quickly. And then Gary Phillips's The Movie Makers, I think it's called. I really enjoyed that. And it was told like from such a different point of view. It's one of the things I really like about the series, actually, the fact that you have all of these different perspectives that shift, whether it's one of the two main characters, you know, told from like criminals in the book. I mean, you just have all of these different points of view. I loved Holly West's installment. It just had like a really beautiful emotional resonance just in terms of what Sam and Rachel went through, in their own relationship in that. And I haven't read some of the most recent ones except for Paul Garth's, which I also really enjoyed. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of it right now.
The Low White Plane.
That's it. You asked me for one, and I'm like, no, they're honestly, they're all great in different ways. So yeah, so that would be a few.
But all good things must come to an end, right?
I can't believe it's coming to an end.
Episode 35 drops on October 1st, Into the Dying Sun. And we say farewell to this couple, at least in terms of on the page. So, you know, you spent time with them and have some investment in who they are and what their fate is. If I handed you the reins and said, why don't you drive this home? How would you end it?
However it ends, happily, unhappily, you know, in a blaze of glory, they will be together. It will be the two of them, I think, in tandem. Sort of, even if that means embracing something awful, even if it means they die together, it's not, I don't think that one of them could leave the other. So I think whatever happens, it's going to be very much, they are tied together through this. And I hope it's not unhappy. I say that, of course, as a writer who has killed off many characters, and I have no ability to, you know, tell another writer, oh, you shouldn't do this. But, you know, because I guess I have spent a lot of time with these characters, I hope that there's always the possibility for more to the story, that maybe even though this is the end, it's maybe the end for now. And there could be more in the future. So that's my hope. But my belief is they will absolutely face it together, whatever comes their way.
It's a good answer. I won't give anything away, but it's an interesting take. So, you know, although you are an official grifter, it is not by even close to the only thing you've written. And so what is your current project, either your most recent release or what you're working on now? And where can folks find out more about you?
Well, let's see. So most recent book release was a book called Her Last Breath, which is published by Thomas and Mercer. And so very, very easy to find. To find out more about me, you can visit my website, which is just my name, hillarydavidson.com.
Well, I wanted to tell you, Hillary, thank you for writing a great story, for being the one Canadian setting out of the whole 35 episodes. We got close to the Canadian border. And for taking part in this retrospective, I really appreciate it. Oh,
thanks so much. I'm so glad that you asked me to be part of it, Frank. I really have enjoyed being part of the Grifter crew.
All right. Thank you, Hillary. I appreciate your insight into your episode of A Grifter Song. One thing I didn't mention before her interview is that another element I really like is that, Rachel has to assume an identity. And in this case, I mean, she does that all the time, right? That's the grifter's game. But here, she's not assuming a fake identity. She's impersonating someone. And that's so that's a neat element too, that you folds in nicely to all the other great things that Hillary did. So check out Dangerous to Know. I will say that it was a finalist for an award. The Crime Writers of Canada nominated Dangerous to Know as Best Novella. So it was a finalist for that award. Being nominated is a pretty big honor. And Crime Writers of Canada, that's a huge honor there. Cool to see Dangerous to Know get the recognition it deserves. All right, let's move on to episode 29, Madam Tomahawk by Nick Kolakowski. Now, just like Hillary, Nick has been on the podcast before. You can go back and listen to a full episode of him talking about his various works. It is a few years old now, so some of his more recent works obviously hadn't come out yet, but you get an idea of his process and the kind of work that he tends to focus on. So I've known Nick in the writing world for years, and I think he reached out and said, hey, I'd be really interested in doing that if you think I'd be a fit sort of email, which he'd been on my radar for a bit as already. And so I was happy to make the invitation, and he delivered. Now, Madam Tomahawk is set in Washington, D.C. I'll let him talk about why he did that, what part of D.C. he's focused on. But it is kind of interesting that it's the first one set in the capital of the country when it's a series about a couple of grifters. So anyway, Sam and Rachel have to help out an old friend, and things go sideways, as they are wont to do in this series. And they come across what could best be termed as a shadow element. And I don't think I want to say any more, because this is one of those episodes, all of them have spoilers and twists in them. This is one that that maybe even has more than some of the others, and I don't want to ruin it. But Nick has a very noir, very gritty style of writing. And like many of the other authors that I've commented on, really evokes a sense of place once again. And of course, like I've said, that's a strength of this series. You feel like you're in Washington, D.C., the D.C. that Nick wants you to experience. So let's find out what Nick has to say about his experience writing Madam Tomahawk, episode 29 of A Grifter Song. Well, hey, Nick, let's just get right into the first question I've been asking everybody. What made you accept the invitation to be part of A Grifter Song?
I feel, how could I not, given that throughout all the seasons and all the episodes, like all these writers I admire, from Eric Buettner to Sean Cosby to you to Matt Phillips, Lawrence Max, I mean, everybody, Paul Garth, everyone's been a part of this. And so to not participate, Holly West, so to not participate in this was sort of giving me a certain sense of FOMO. You know, kind of felt that I almost needed to be part of it, just because there's been so many great names over so many seasons. That was the motivator. And also, I mean, within crime fiction itself, the book series has built up this sterling reputation of carrying its quality from season to season to season, which is not something you can say for any long running series, whether written or television or movies or whatever. I mean, usually there's a fade out at a certain point, but kind of having this constant infusion of fresh blood with all these authors, made it really tempting to jump on no matter what the season was.
In your case, you were, I think, the first person to, the only person to set your story in, Hellspawn, itself, you know, Washington, D.C. Was this a story that you came up with once you came on board, or was this an idea maybe that had its birth elsewhere and then just seemed to fit?
So, yeah, the D.C. is the grifter's capital of the world. So, I mean, it seems logical to set a story there. But I grew up in D.C. And one thing that it had irritated me for many years is that every single thriller and mystery, with the exception of George Pelicanos, that you read or watch that's set in D.C., it's always the White House and the Capitol and a couple of federal buildings around it. And if you knew nothing about D.C., you would think that was the entirety of the city. But it's actually a really vibrant, gritty, interesting city for many miles, kind of all around, with all sorts of different eclectic neighborhoods and communities, groups and things like that. So I'd always wanted to explore that and to write something that plunged into it. And I felt that this was, because again, grifter's capital world, two grifters trying to make their way in an entire giant deep sea of grifters. I thought it was the perfect opportunity to do a story set in the other DC, and very specifically set in the DC that I grew up in. So U Street, Adams Morgan, Glover Park, Cleveland Park, all the areas that people who don't live there won't necessarily see often represented in fiction. And in terms of the story itself, when I was growing up, I grew up the street a little bit from Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State at the very close of the 20th century. And growing up, all the lefty commie middle schoolers referred to her as Madame Tomahawk, because Madame Secretary, Madame Tomahawk, her method of foreign policy, people felt, was to encourage Bill to launch, you know, tomahawks and missiles and armies at anything that sort of looked at the U.S. funny. And that name always stuck with me. And so simultaneous to that, I had this idea of, and I don't want to spoil too much of the book, but somebody who kind of was a tool of all these political operators who went around and did the actual visceral dirty work. And I was really stumped on thinking up a nickname for her as she sort of went around dispensing her own sort of twisted method of, you know, balancing the scales for these political operators. And then finally I was like, Madame Tomahawk, that works. Because as you know, the original title was going to be a capital grift, which I initially liked, but then it felt too much like the title of an old vaudeville tune or something like that. And I kind of, it seemed cornier and cornier the more I thought about it. And so I decided to slap that in. So I guess it was a case where it was 75% had been there for years. And then it just took, you know, our heroic duo and sort of structuring a story around them for me to kind of bring all these elements together.
Now, had you ever written in a scenario before where there were, you know, guidelines in place or, you know, foul lines that you had to stay within? And if not, or even if so, how was that experience for you?
So I have done a couple of ghostwriting and work for hire projects over the years, novels that came to me as a fleshed out outline with complete characters. And I was expected to paint within the lines and connect the dots and deliver a manuscript back, which I did. And I think a lot of writers have a similar experience to do these things because somebody's willing to pay you for it. And I didn't like those previous experiences because the things that you find oftentimes in those sort of ghostwriting scenarios is that people, even if you say, you know, this won't work for logical reasons or this character needs to be adjusted so that it becomes a better arc, oftentimes you're dealing with people who are very wedded to their ideas and very bonded to it, and they want things done a certain way, even if it's not going to work. And so you eventually sort of shrug your shoulders and do it. The thing that I really loved about this process of the Grifter Song by comparison is that you obviously gave us the outline and the story Bible, but then you gave us incredible latitude to do what we do best. But the latitude, I found this experience a lot better than what I had dealt with previously because it could sort of meld it to my own vision.
Was there anything about Sam or Rachel that drew you to this story or that you discovered as you wrote it that you particularly liked about them?
So I sort of compare the two of them to catfish in a certain way. And that sounds a little bit weird, except that there are creatures in nature that are extremely hard to kill when you hunt them or fish them. And you begin to admire that tenacity and that toughness and that refusal to die. And that's what I really love about this duo in particular, is that throughout all these books, everything gets thrown at them. They constantly deal with the worst of the worst and just these escalating horrific situations, and they manage to survive and sometimes even prosper. And I have a real attachment to that idea. It's also interesting too, because I'd read several books previously in the series, and it's kind of difficult to come up with a fresh scenario because so many of the previous authors have done so many inventive, dark things. It's like, what can you possibly throw at these people who have survived everything before? So that was also fun too, trying to come up with something that nobody else had done.
Yeah, they really hadn't dealt with high political stakes before. You mentioned that you had read some of the other episodes. Did any of those stand out to you as personal favorites?
Yeah, The Low White Plain by Paul Garth was one that I really enjoyed, just because the bleakness of the Dakotas.
Nebraska,
thank you. Mm-hmm. And kept escalating and escalating. And by the end of it, with everything on fire and so on, it just seemed like a really nice progression. Yeah, I mean, they're all in their different ways. They've all been inspirational. I think everyone who writes these things, and also, I mean, everyone who's been writing these, they also do short stories and novels. Everyone is a real master of the form.
Was there a point in your own story that you kind of sat back and thought, this is a cool part, I really like this?
The very beginning of my episode takes place in a bar that's a very thinly veiled version of the Brass Monkey, which, if you live in DC, is a notoriously rowdy bar in Adams Morgan. And the situation that kicks off the book, where the two of them step in to adjudicate a situation between a man and a woman that seems to be spiraling out of control, is based on something that I actually witnessed probably about 15 years ago in DC one Friday night. And so putting that into, not only putting that into fiction, but kind of giving it an even more satisfying, bone crunching denouement, I thought was a really sort of viscerally, I mean, it's not often sometimes when I write that I get like a really viscerally satisfying sense that something's been corrected, even on kind of a karmic level. But I really, that's probably the sequence I had the most fun writing.
Your story came pretty late, episode number 29, pretty late in the mythology of Sam and Rachel. It's all coming to an end on October 1st with episode 35, Into the Dying Sun. How would you end it?
It's so tough because I have an emotional attachment to these characters, and I would, after so many episodes of push pull where they either get away with some money, but inevitably they're going to have to start grifting again, or they just get away with their lives and some slight injuries, but they lose the money. A big part of me wants them to get away with something. But on the other hand, they also have that grifter nature. And I think episode after episode, they've demonstrated that, you know, even when, you know, they think that this is going to be the ultimate score for them, you know, in your heart of hearts that they're going to want to grift again. It's just in their nature. They're going to want to grift again. I definitely don't want them to die. I hope they don't die. I mean, if they have to die, they have to die. But after so many adventures across the country and so on, I just really hope that's not the case.
So, you know, a grifter song, obviously you had a big part in it, an important episode, but it's not the only thing that you've done, obviously. What do you have going on next that people can check out, and where can they find out more about you?
So I recently published Hell of a Mess, which is the fourth book in the Love and Bullet series. It also, that book is about Bill and Fiona, who have like some rough similarities to the Grifter song in the sense that Bill is a hustler. Fiona is more of an assassin, but in this fourth book, they are trapped and they execute a heist in the middle of a hurricane in Lower Manhattan. And the hurricane is far stronger than predicted, which forces them to try to survive not only people who are gunning for them, but also rising floodwaters and all the other terrible things that come with hurricanes. I'm also working on an untitled detective novel at the moment. I just finished doing the first draft that is set in the Northern California foothills. Involves a ancient mystery, a winery, and some other things.
Where's the best place people can find out more about those projects and your back catalog?
NickKolakowski.com.
Well, Nick, I wanted to say thanks for choosing a place that nobody else had chosen yet for your episode, for writing a great episode, and for being part of this project.
Awesome. Yeah, no, thank you for having me. It's been a real fascinating experience. I loved every minute of it.
All right. Thank you, Nick. You know, another person who is obviously very thoughtful when it comes to his work. You saw that in Hillary's interview as well. It's a real honor to be associated with these writers who are just so intelligent and so mindful of their craft, Paul and Hillary and Nick in this episode, but there's been 30 of them, you know, and it's just been a real thrill to hear about their different processes, but to see that all of them are just focused on creating art in a way that has layer and nuance and impact and brings their vision to the page. And I think it's a huge challenge to do that with somebody else's characters and in a rule book. And they've all thrived under it. Even those who said it was difficult managed to thrive under it. Anyway, so Madame Tomahawk, great story. I don't think I need to say any more about that I didn't say in the interview with Nick. I think what I liked best about this story, the specific thing that's different is Nick's writing style and the fact that he chose to show a piece of DC that maybe isn't what you necessarily think of when you think of our nation's capital. In fact, almost certainly isn't if you don't live there. So that will do it for our discussions of episodes 27, 28, and 29, The Low White Plain by Paul J. Garth, Dangers to Know by Hillary Davidson, and Madame Tomahawk by Nick Kolakowski. Next episode, we are going to talk to T.G. Wolf about her episode number 30, Good For It, and then number 31, Outfoxed by Jeffrey Hess, and number 32, Somewhere Outside Salvation, by James D.F. Hanna. I want to say thank you to Paul, Hillary, and Nick for coming on the show, talking about their episodes. And thank you to you, the listener, for listening to this celebration of A Grifter's Song and for checking out these authors. You know, I chose them all for a very specific reason and for their ability to bring something to the series. And every one of them is a talented author with their own distinct style and voice. They're all worth checking out, and I can almost guarantee you're going to find some favorites once you delve into their work. So give them a try. Of course, you can start with their novella in A Grifter's Song. That would not hurt my feelings at all. All right, we will see you next episode. We are two episodes from the end, my friend. So see you then. Until that time, this is Frank Zaffiro reminding you that sometimes you gotta be in the wrong place to write crime.